So it's the 12th of May, 2019, in the farm in Auburn, Washington, near Seattle. And we're looking at finding our nature, figuring out who we are. This is not about finding our eternal spiritual nature. This is about finding our nature in this world. And we would like to find our nature in this world because Krishna tells us to act according to our nature. So if we don't know what it is, it's kind of hard to do that. Right?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. And Krishna wants us to have our nature connected to our income stream. So Krishna's desire is that who we are, what we are, how we work best is the way that we maintain ourselves. There's a connection between that and our livelihood. Within the last month, I saw a diagram of a Japanese conception. I forget what it's called exactly. Where there were four overlapping circles.
Ikigai.
Ikigai, is that what it is?
I think so.
Ikigai? That sounds terrible.
I know.
Sure, it means something lovely in Japanese. Anyway, one is what you love, what you're good at, what you can make money at, and what the world needs. That was it, yeah?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. What the world needs, what you can make money at, what you love, what you're good at. The intersection of all of those. So that's a very similar, it's not exactly the same, but it's a very similar conception as to what's being taught in the Bhagavad Gita. Now, on the ultimate spiritual platform, our Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta, our understanding, is that the highest perfection of life is that we realize our eternal spiritual nature, who I am, my spiritual name, my form, my qualities, my work, and I do that in Krishna's service in the spiritual world. Am I correct about that? Did I get that right? Yes? Yes? No? You're not sure? Should I repeat that again? Our Gaudiya Vaishnava understanding of the ultimate perfection is when I realize my eternal nature, my form, my name, my qualities, and I do that for Krishna eternally in the spiritual world. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. So this idea that I find out who I am and I use who I am, authentically who I am, in the service of the Lord, that is our understanding of ultimate perfection. Now, in this world, my identity is not my eternal identity. My nationality, ethnicity, gender, physical abilities, intellectual abilities, what I like to do, is not the same as my eternal spiritual nature. This body and this mind is a vehicle that I'm in. But this vehicle that I'm in still has certain things that it's good at and certain things that it's not good at. Just like, there's a variety of vehicles here. And they're not all exactly good at the same thing, although they all get you to your destination, but a little differently. Now, what to speak if we're not just talking about cars, but if there's cars and there's bicycles and there's motorcycles and there's a boat and there's a helicopter. So, although we're not the car and we're not the helicopter and we're not the bicycle and we're not the skateboard, knowing how to use this body and mind that we're in, what is it good for? What is it not good for? Where am I going to feel comfortable? We could talk about our nature is where we're the most enlivened, like where we feel most energized, where we feel most satisfied, where we feel most authentic. It's also the place we go when we're under stress. So we can pretend to be somebody we're not, but when there's some sort of stress, we go to who we are. Right? So it's the place we feel most happy, most energized, most ourselves. And it's also our default value when we don't have the energy to maintain a pretense. It's what we also go to. It's also how we understand the world. It's how we make sense out of the world. The kind of patterns and relationships that we see. The way that we explain things. It's also how we act when nobody asks us and nobody pays us. It's what we do so naturally, like breathing, that sometimes it gets hard to identify what our nature is because it just sort of is. So sometimes it's easier for other people to see what we are than for us to see what we are. We have a very simple example of this. I was just in Denver, and every class that I gave there, there was this one brahmachari who at the end of the class would ask all of these kind of debate questions. And not challenging in a rude way, he was a very respectful person, but really in-depth challenging everything that I said. And after a couple classes, I said, it's clear that this is your nature. You know, you're obviously a very philosophical, intellectual person who likes to debate. And he said, well, no, I'm not. And it was really interesting because the head of the Brahmachari Ashram was there, and he just started laughing. And he said, yes, this is definitely your nature. So I thought that was very interesting because he wasn't able to see it in himself, and I was able to see it in 2 days. Right? So sometimes things that we just do all the time, we're not that aware of ourselves. So we're going to be looking at several ways of understanding what our nature is. Some of the ways we're going to be looking at it from Shastra. Some of the ways we're going to be looking at it are from modern psychology and sociology. Why am I giving you this range? Because this is so each of us as individuals can then put this together to get a composite picture. Now I want you to keep in mind that the different things we're looking at are all simplified. So most of the things we're looking at are going to have 3 categories or 4 categories or 6 categories. And you cannot possibly divide all human beings up into 4 or 6 or 3 categories. We're all very complex beings. Yes? And each of us, in one sense, is unique. So even if we can say, okay, there are 5 people here that all fit in this nature, even those 5 people are going to have their unique takes on it. So although you're going to end up with some groups of labels that you can use for yourself, keep in mind that each of us is our own individual. And no 2 people, even identical twins, are exactly the same physiologically, what to speak of psychologically. Understanding our nature is not an exercise in pride. It's not, well, my nature is better than yours. That would be like saying, well, what's better, your heart or your lungs? You know, it's a ridiculous question. You know, each organ in your body has its function. And even though we'd much rather live without our legs than our lungs, nobody wants to live without their legs. Right? Our legs are also very important. In fact, our legs in the Bhagavatam are ruled by Vishnu, which is very interesting. So you could say, you know, well, the brain's more important than the legs. But I like my legs. I like them. I don't want to get rid of them. I want them to work. I don't want to have to be in a wheelchair or on crutches. So to say, you know, one nature is more valuable than another, one nature is better than another, is really not what's at issue here at all. Whatever nature I have in this life is best for me in this life. So understanding our nature is not a question of making some kind of compare and contrast in order to be prideful, nor is it an excuse. Well, of course, I act like that. It's just my nature. It's not an excuse for bad behavior. Okay, so that's kind of an overview. And I can only give you today, in an hour and a half, obviously, breadth rather than depth. So these are topics I've been studying for many, many years, and to get into them requires some more study than I can do in this brief introduction. But a brief introduction is enough for you to go and say, oh, okay, this is a way that I should work and this is a way I should not work. Knowing our nature means, oh, now I know where I can go to feel most energized and where I can really be in my strengths. And I can also know what things I should probably avoid if I can. And if I have to be in an area of weakness, then I give myself a little slack that I know I'm not going to do it that well. Do you follow? If there's an emergency and I have to act in an area that's not my nature, in an area of my weakness, then I can intentionally do some sort of compensatory behaviors. I can say, all right, I'm going to intentionally try to adjust the way I normally behave with the idea that I want this to be as temporary as possible. Another thing one can do, understanding one's strengths and weaknesses, is especially if you're in any kind of management or leadership, is to have other people on your team to compensate for your areas of weakness. To say, okay, I know I'm really good at this and I'm not really good at that. Many years ago, I used to regularly visit one temple, which I shall not name, which was a very vibrant and exciting temple. It was a temple in North America, and there were people there of every demographic, every race, ethnicity, marital status, age, everything. People were regularly studying Prabhupada's books, going to the programs. It was a vibrant, exciting place. One of the most vibrant and exciting temples in North America. And then I went there, I skipped a few years where I didn't go, and when I went back again, the place was dead. I mean, it was just completely dead. I stayed in the temple, Mangal Arati, it was me and the pujari. Bhagavatam class, it was me and two people. I mean, there was nobody there. And at a big festival program, there were 600 people there, but they told me, you know, these 600 people are from two Gujarati families. And I said, you know, what happened to this place? And they said, well, our last temple president got the temple into debt. So we got rid of him, and we got a man who's really good at money management. I said, you know, you should have kept the old temple president and got a new treasurer. You know, now you got your money situation under control, but there's nothing happening here. Before there was everything happening and you were going into debt. So to understand, okay, I'm good at this, I'm not good at this, let me have people who are in my areas of weakness who can compensate. And this means being a little honest that I'm not God and I'm not strong in everything, which may be very difficult for some of us to deal with. But, you know, I'm not going to be good at everything. I do need other people to support me. You know, like many times with husband and wife, I'll hear people saying, oh, my wife's so different than me in this way, my husband's so different. I say, no, that's a good thing. Because you're each giving some sort of strength to the relationship. And the children are they'll say, oh, my children get this, my husband does this way, I do it this way. I said, but that's actually good. Because you're doing some things he's not good at doing, and he's doing some things that you're not good at. All right, so this is why we're doing this and what I hope you'll get out of this. Okay, so the first thing that we're going to pass around is, this is take one, pass it around. And this will be as efficient as we can get. Take one, pass it different directions. This particular analysis is from the Ayurveda. I like to start with this because I like to start with something that you can see is Shastric. And I also like to start with something that really exemplifies the principles of nature as given in the Bhagavad Gita. So how many of you are already familiar with the Ayurvedic types? Okay, good. So you may be aware that the Ayurvedic types apply not only to your physical body, but also to one's mentality. So what we're looking at here is the Ayurvedic types applied to mentality. Now, if you're familiar with Ayurvedic types, you'll know that most people are not just one type. So most people are not just Vata or just Pitta or just Kapha, but there's some combination. So most people are like Vata Pitta or Pitta Kapha or Kapha Vata or something like that. But there's generally one type that's dominant, there may be another type that's less dominant, and then one type that's not dominant at all. That's what it's like for most people. And with some people, it's some combination of all three, etc. But the main thing I want you to look at here is just understanding a certain principle. That here you see all three types in each of the three modes of nature. So here you can see a Vata person in ignorance, a Vata person in passion, a Vata person in goodness. And the reason I like to start off with this chart is to show that one type isn't better than another. At the bottom, we have a quote from Prabhupada that says, fire represents goodness, water passion, and sky ignorance, which may then give you the impression that if you have a vata mentality, you're going to be in the mode of ignorance. But you can have a vata mentality in ignorance, passion, or goodness. And you can have a pitta mentality in the mode of ignorance, or passion, or goodness. So here it's not so much about what type one has, but what mode of nature one is exhibiting that type in. And such is the main instruction of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna never told Arjuna, change your nature. Did he ever say that? Never. He said, it's how you use it. Do you use it for me, Krishna was saying, or are you using it for your own ego? And what mode are you using it? Krishna, in fact, makes it very clear. He said, everyone will act according to their nature. What does, what's the word? Repression accomplish. Krishna is very clear, and I've heard devotees say, you can change your nature. According to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that is incorrect. Is it possible to change your nature? It's possible. Vishwamitra did it. It took him 60,000 years. And he really struggled with it. You know, he had his ups and downs to go from one nature to another. So is it theoretically possible in one life to change your nature? Sure, if you want to put 60,000 years into it. I don't think that's really practical for most of us. And Krishna's not even advising that we do that. He's saying, change how you use it. So let's take just a few minutes, just take a look at this, and pick any one of the columns that you like, doesn't matter which one of the columns you pick, and just look at the differences between using that nature in the three modes. Just pick any one nature, doesn't matter which one it is, and just look at the differences between the three modes. Anyone have some thoughts after looking it over?
So I had a question regarding Prabhupada's comment on the bottom of the page. So fire represents mode of goodness and water represents mode of passion. Isn't it the other way?
I actually don't want to take time in this particular seminar to address that particular point, although it's a very interesting point. And that point is very connected to a whole description in the third canto from Kapila Dev with Sankhya Yoga. So it's a worthy and important discussion, but I'm concerned that if we go there now, that it will be a distraction from the main points I want to make. If you please excuse me, that I don't go there. Yes.
Is it that one's shortcomings and one's positive aspects are two sides of the same coin?
Thank you. Exactly. Exactly. You've gotten it exactly. And one's positive qualities and one's shortcomings are two sides of the same coin. They are really exactly the same thing. It's just how you use it. You see, often we think about, you know, I want to become a perfect person. But what we're trying to become is the perfect version of ourselves, which is going to look different from the perfect version of somebody else. So here you have three, again, simplified types. And if you look in the mode of goodness, they're different from each other, aren't they? They're each the best example of themselves. Yes. Exactly. Some other thoughts on this?
So is the intersection of, like, when you say nature cannot be changed, is it the intersection of the Ayurvedic type and the mode? Like sattvic and vata, is one, is that nature or?
What can be changed is the modes.
Modes can be changed.
The modes can be changed. Okay. So therefore, Krishna is giving so much instruction in the Bhagavad Gita about how to change the modes. He gives no instruction in the Gita about how to change your nature. In fact, he says, you can't. You cannot repress your nature. But he gives a lot of instructions about how to come to higher modes. And a lot of instructions about how to come out of the modes altogether and come to bhakti, which we didn't put bhakti here. So yes, you can definitely change your modes and you can get out of the modes and come to... That you can do. Yes.
So when you use the modes to change, to reach that point with Krishna's advice, doesn't it mean that your nature automatically changes?
Not at all. So if you see here, you'll see that as a person goes up from ignorance to passion to goodness, their basic nature hasn't changed, but how they're exhibiting it changes. Mm-hmm. What they're doing with it changes. And that may look superficially as if they've changed their nature. But they haven't. They've just changed what they're doing with it. Their basic wiring hasn't changed at all.
But if you transcend the mode, that means you transcend the bodily, whatever you type, kind of thing, in a transcendental nature, you still be remaining like vata pitta.
Now that's a very interesting question. So let's say one transcends the body and the mind and is fully identifying with one's eternal spiritual form. So let's say you fully realize, you know, that you're a cowherd boy named whatever, all right, and that your nature as a cowherd boy is such and such and such and such. The thing is that you still have this particular body and mind that is designed to work in a particular way. So if I stop identifying with the car I'm driving, I'm still driving the same car. Now it is possible, Srila Prabhupada says, for a person in that kind of realization to act in any way. That is possible. But generally we find, with practically no exceptions, that even such persons continue to act in this world according to the nature of their body and their mind. I mean, it makes sense because this particular body and mind have a certain kind of default way of acting. And also, there's every nature that we can possibly have has some place in Krishna's desires. Maybe we can have a window or a door open because it's kind of stuffy. The window is difficult. The door doesn't have a screen, and the window is difficult. Because we have a lot of people in this room.
Open the door.
So a little bit, we definitely have a little bit stuffy.
It's a pine needle. Yeah, almost a pine.
Stuck. Oh, here we got a window. All right.
That open?
Yeah. That one open. Okay, thank you. That one is more difficult. Oh, there we go.
The combination lock.
Combination lock window. All right. Thank you. So, yeah, many times devotees will think that. Well, also, first of all, devotees often think they've transcended the modes after they've been chanting for a week or two. So that's one thing is, you know, well, I've been chanting Hare Krishna for a week, now I can do anything for Krishna. And that's, we find, quite obviously not true. Their nature reasserts itself. And the other thing is that generally Krishna doesn't want us acting differently than the mundane nature, even if we are transcendental. Now, we do find that devotees sometimes waste a lot of time trying to imitate someone else's nature instead of trying to be the best of their own nature. And sometimes we push other people to imitate someone else's nature instead of trying to be the best of their nature. And that can especially happen if my nature is different from yours. So if I'm your mother or father and I have one nature and you have another, I might try to get you to be like me. So if we like the way we are, we may try to think that everybody should be like me. And if I don't like the way I am, I should think I should try to be like somebody else. Both of which I've seen as major energy vacuums from our real business of just becoming Krishna conscious with who we are. Any other thoughts on this?
I'm looking at this chart. Can you give us an example of something? And
we will. We will. Right now I'm just trying to get principles.
Have a question.
Yes.
Can you have multiple ones from each different nature?
Well, as I said, this is a very simplified form. Mm-hmm. And in the Ayurvedic model, most people are a combination of two, with one being stronger than the other. So most people are going to be pitta-vata, with pitta being stronger than vata, or vata-pitta with vata being stronger than pitta, or pitta-kalpa. So very few people are just one of these three.
Well, all three.
Well, we all have some of all three, or we'd be dead or extremely sick. So we all have some of all three, but one is going to be very dominant. And I like that you asked that, because to some extent, all of us can do almost anything of anyone's nature to some extent, in some ways, and in some circumstances. But our nature indicates, again, where are we most comfortable, where are we most energized, where are we most ourselves? Where do we go to under stress? And how do we see the world? How do we understand the world? So it doesn't define us totally. We can do the work of someone else's nature temporarily, and we will exhibit things of other people's nature in certain circumstances. But it's not where we feel most comfortable. And if we try to act like someone else over a prolonged period of time, we'll feel drained and exhausted. We may feel irritated. We'll feel restrained in some way. Sometimes we'll feel that our ethical boundaries are being violated simply because we're acting according to someone else's nature, and something which I don't think I'll have time to get into today, but we cause havoc in the social body when we act according to someone else's nature. Any other questions just on this principle before we start going into specifics? All right. So we're going to look at a very, very simple four-category system of understanding nature. This was developed in modern psychology. This is one of the psychological systems of understanding nature. It is not by any means the only one. There are many others. I like to use this one because it's extremely simple to teach, it's extremely simple to understand, and it's extremely simple to apply. Whenever you have something that's extremely simple to teach, to understand, and apply, that means there's some distortion. So the systems that have 16 types or 50 types, like I studied a 50-type system, are much, much, much harder to teach and understand and apply, but they give you more accurate information. Everybody follow that? Okay? So whenever you have something that you can explain in 10 minutes, you're leaving out some of the crucial information. But I found that learning this particular system, it just opened up my view of the world. When I first learned this, it was when I was at an education conference. All of a sudden, I went, wow. I can be okay who I am. It was such a revelation for me. And it helped me as a teacher to guide kids to be the best of who they were. So please keep in mind, this is a simple system. A simple system always has distortions and deletions. But it's something that we can understand very quickly. All right, so this is a four-category system, and a four-category system, it has only two parameters. It has two parameters in basically a matrix, which gives you four types. So in these two parameters, the first one we're going to look at is, are we more people-oriented or task-oriented? So how do you feel most energized? When you're with a bunch of people or when you're getting things done? Now, all of us like to get things done. We all like to check off something on our to-do list. I got something done. And everyone likes to be with people, at least some people, sometimes. Right? Even the most task-oriented person probably has at least one or two good friends that they will like to hang out with. So we all have some people orientation and some task orientation. But if you had to choose what was more dominant, I mean, if you were working on getting something done and friends came over, would you think, oh, no, God, they're interrupting my work. Maybe I can get them to help with my work. Or if you were doing some job and friends came over, would you say, great, I can put aside my work and hang out with my friends. So if you had to choose, which were you more overall? This is not an absolute, but which are you more? Who would say, I'm more people-oriented than task-oriented? Who would say, I'm more task-oriented than people-oriented? Okay. Now we're going to look at the next parameter. And this is whether we're faster-paced or slower-paced. You could call it outgoing or reserved. So am I more upfront and fast-paced? or the behind and more slow pace? Am I more risk-taker or am I more cautious? Again, we're all a little bit of both. You can't be a total risk-taker crossing the street or you wouldn't still be here. And you can't be totally cautious or you'd never get out of bed. Right? So, nobody's all the way risk-taker or all the way cautious. Nobody's fast-paced all the time. Even fast-paced people slow down and are cautious to do some things in their life. But they may feel all the time like, why can't I go faster? Right? And even very slow-paced, cautious people sometimes have to do things in a hurry, but they generally feel, why am I being rushed? So again, we all have some outgoing in reserve. We all have some slow-paced, fast-paced. But if we had to choose overall, in a holistic way, who'd say they're more outgoing and fast-paced? Always a minority. And who would say they're more reserved and slow-paced? Okay. So this gives you now, with these two parameters, four types. People outgoing, people reserved, task outgoing, task reserved. Okay, you're going to get a whole bunch of papers now.
Whole book.
There are books on this. And if I have enough advanced planning, I actually can order books for this seminar. So I have done that. I have actually ordered books for this seminar, but I really need, that needs to be arranged like 6 weeks in advance. Okay. And in the books we have, this is all the same thing. The books also have a test that you can do. Okay, now you're gonna get this one. Okay? This is now the second one. But you should actually do them back.
Yeah.
Okay, you should now have two. Everyone should have these two?
Yeah. Yes.
One is double-sided.
Yeah.
One is double-sided, yes. Okay, then you're going to get three different ones that all say DISC at the top and all have a table. Okay, this is one with a very simple table, just 4x2. This is a 4x5. We have a 4x6, 5x16. So you shall have five, in addition to the one you got at first on Ayurveda, you shall have now an additional five. So everybody should have altogether six distinct papers. You should have five about this DISC. And those of you who are listening to this on the recording, I have this on my website, arunadevidasi.org, seminars and workshops, handouts.
I can forward the handouts to all of you.
Oh, very nice. But any of you who are listening to this and recording at a different time and place, you can get the handouts there. All right, the one I'd like us to look at first is the one with the smallest table that just says qualities under control and qualities out of control. Because this is showing, again, the basic thing that, Michael, you pointed out, that our nature is two sides of the same coin. So if you look at this one, DISC, your D are your outgoing, task-oriented people. So fast-paced, outgoing, task-oriented. I are your outgoing, fast-paced, people-oriented. S are your reserve, slower pace, people oriented, and C are your reserve, slower pace, task oriented. Now, by the way, if you do get this material and take a test, you'll also often find that you might have two of these qualities near the top. So some people are mostly I, but a lot of D. Or mostly S, but a lot of C. So often, again, you might have two of these dominant, but one is always going to be, or almost always going to be, the most dominant. So let's look at the D column, which is your outgoing, task-oriented person. And you'll notice we have courageous and then reckless. Do you all notice this?
Yeah.
Do you all notice? Now, what is the difference between courageous and reckless? What's the difference?
One is not thinking about the consequences when you react.
It's about the consequences. So if you're in a war zone and there's bullets flying, and you rush out in front of the flying bullets to save your injured buddy and bring him to safety, you're courageous. And if you just close your eyes and run out in the middle of a highway, you're reckless. But it's the same behavior, isn't it? It's just one is for a good purpose and one is for a foolish purpose. But it's exactly the same behavior. Clear? And you'll see this with everything. Look under C, orderly and compulsive. It's the same quality. Logical or critical, it's the same quality. Intense or unsociable, curious or nosy. What's the difference between curious and nosy? It's the same quality. But one is being used positively and one is being used negatively. Under S, relaxed and lacking initiative. It's the same quality. All right? So why don't you take a minute, and whatever your dominant type is, take a look at the column for your own dominant type. If you look at this one, you'll see why they picked those particular letters. But D is outgoing task, I is outgoing people, S is reserved people, C is reserved task. And if you want to reference this paper, is your reference for that. This is your reference paper. By the way, these types are not evenly distributed in the population. So what did you think of looking over your dominant type and the in control and out of control? Did it give some sense about how you could use your nature in a positive way?
Yeah?
Okay, let's look at some overall. Let's look at this sheet, which doesn't have any table or any graphics on it. Okay, so we're just going from top to bottom. So the first is your task-oriented outgoing. Those are your Ds. And they've given D words, dominant driving doers, with a symbol of an exclamation point. Emphatic in everything they do. They're focused. Get the job done. Just do it. Overcome opposition. Achieve your goals. Winners never quit and quitters never win. And what do these people need? Challenge, control, and choices. Their outlook in life is to lead or to be in charge. They can be self-sufficient, relying on natural abilities and talents to get them through difficult situations. never satisfied with the status quo, constantly looking for new and better ideas and ways of doing things. Then the next, the eyes, people-oriented, outgoing. So we have eye words, inspirational, influencing, impulsive. The symbol is the star. They love recognition and being the center of attention. The focus is, I am for you. If we all pull in the same direction and stay motivated, there is no end to the success and fun we can have. Basic needs are recognition, approval, and popularity. That's quite different than the basic needs of the D, wasn't it? So suppose you try to give a D recognition, approval, and popularity. Is that going to do it for them?
No.
No. I suppose you give an I challenge, control, and choices. Is that going to do it for them? No. That's not what I wanted to eat. Right? Outlook on life, to persuade others to their way of thinking. These are your persuasive, influential people. High eyes are very friendly, seem to talk to or wave to everyone they see. They know no strangers. After you've been with them 5 minutes, you feel like you've known them your whole life. Okay, then people-oriented, reserved. This is your S. Steady, stable, and supportive. So S words. They bring a balance to the people equation. Their focus is all for one and one for all. If we all work together, we can make a great team. Working together, we can do it. Their basic needs, appreciation, security, and approval. Outlook on life, to provide necessary support to help get the job completed. And S is orderly and efficient, preferring to know that things are running smoothly. They prefer the standard, tried, and proven ways of doing things. One of their mottos is, working together, we can do it. Then the C's, task-oriented and reserved, competent, cautious, careful. Those are our C words. Their symbol is the question mark. Oh, the symbol for the S is the plus minus. Question mark. They want to know the why behind what they do. Their focus is to make sure things are done in a correct manner. Goods and services provided with quality ensure long-standing relationships. Their basic needs are quality, answers, excellence, and value. That's quite different needs, isn't it?
Yeah.
Outlook on life, to be conscientious and consistent. The C type is usually extremely gifted, very bright, a high capacity for intellectual achievement. They know how to take a big project and break it down into little components. All right, so a little simplified form is this double-sided one, where you can see the DISC, the D with the, we have the symbols here, the exclamation mark, the star, the plus minus, and the question mark. So this is basically the same information, it's just in a little bit simpler form. The layout is a little bit nicer. All right, let's look at the tables. Let's look at the table with the most boxes in it first. I think that was like 16 by 5 table. Okay, so let's look at outlook or orientation. For a D, bottom line, money, profit. For an I, fun, travel, position. For an S, helping people, building friendships. For a C, product, value, excellence. Blind spot. D, appreciating others' feelings. I, disorganization. They do piling instead of filing. S, being possessive. They live by order and tranquility. And C, being critical, demanding too much of self and others. So each of these types has a problem.
Yeah.
Clues to look for. If you go into somebody's office or home, a D is likely to have a big desk, a nice office, and a lot of whirlwind action going on. An I is likely to have a picture of family and a disorganized desk. An S is likely to have charts nearby, manuals organized, and C, everything neat and tidy and filed. When cornered, a D will fight their way out, an I will talk their way out. An S don't want to be put in a corner, they'll either crumble or fight, and a C will act like a D and get defensive. The Ds like to do things the fastest way. I is the most fun way. S, the traditional way, and C, the proper way. Approach to tasks. Ds, get it done now. I, put it off until later. S, get help from others, and C, I'll just get it done myself. The way they process information. The Ds, let's do it, get finished. Is, let's have some fun. S, slow down and help me. C, will you answer my question first? How they handle a budget? Go over it briefly. I was once working with a D, and whenever I'd give this D person a budget, they would just say, okay, can we go on to the next item on the agenda? And I just, budget? What's a budget? That temple I was talking about, it was being run by a very high I. Very, very high. An S person will always stay under the budget because they're very cautious. So they're always going to make sure there's some money left. And the C will just stay within it. Now make sure they spend right at the budget. Okay? The Ds are driving things by their willpower, I's by their inspiration, S by their feelings and emotions, and C by their mind and intellect. The key strength of a D is being firm, of an I is being fun, of an S is being friendly, and a C is being factual. If you go in any community and you say, who are the nicest people in this community? Give me a list of the nicest people. I guarantee you, you will get all S's. They are very friendly. It's the plus minus sign. I remember once my cousin was working for a devotee who was clearly a high S. And he said, Ermila, I love working with this devotee. He just gets along with everybody. Everybody loves him. Everybody can get along with him. And after a couple weeks of working with him, he came home and he said, this guy is so wishy-washy. I said, it's the same quality. You can't get along with everybody if you have highly held opinions on anything. Right? The most friendly. Yes. Key weaknesses. The D's are not very friendly. The I's are not very factual. The S are not very firm, and the C's are not much fun. The key to success for a D is to learn to be under authority. These are the weaknesses, that if one can conquer them, one can get success. To learn to work under authority, for the I's to learn to be more credible, for S's to learn to be more decisive, and for C's to learn to be more supportive. Now, if you want to motivate people, one reason to understand this is not only for yourself, but how do you motivate others? What energizes each of us is different. If I try to energize you by what energizes me, it may not work. So for D's is, I want you to be in charge. Hey, can you take charge of this? Yes! For an I is, you can do it. And they're like, yes. For an S is, I need your help. Oh, yes, I'm here for you. And for the C is, can I have your best thinking? Oh, yes, definitely. I'll research that. What kills you is, you can't do that.
No, it's an exclamation mark.
Yes, you can't do that. It's not allowed. Tell a D they can't do it, they'll go, you want to see me do it? And for the I guys, so you think that's funny, huh? For the S's, you're not very nice, because that's the whole essence of an S, is I'm nice. And for the C, you made a mistake. There's one high C person that I work with in my service. Whoa, I cannot tell this person that you made a mistake. Prabhu, do you think you might have quoted that verse wrong there? Okay, so in order to be productive and get along with people who are not us, so D's need to remember to communicate often, to reward achievement, to practice patience, improve listening skills, and display more empathy. So basically, this last column is how you can talk to people who don't speak your language. That's what this last row is about. For the eyes, to use short-term goals, behave responsibly, follow written plans, keep commitments, and focus on listening. For S's, accept challenges readily, demonstrate flexibility, voice opinions and ideas, concentrate on deadlines, exercise assertiveness. For C's, show more optimism, act more spontaneously, simplify their ideas, decide more quickly, and control perfectionism. So this is when you're dealing with people who are not your type. If you don't adjust a little bit, it's just like here in America, I am speaking English fast. I am speaking at my normal rate. I'm considering that all of you here have been in America long enough, or you've grown up here, that you can understand me. As soon as I get out of this country, I speak like this. And I don't say water, I say water. Because I know if I'm speaking to people who are not accustomed to an American speed of English, they will not be able to understand me. So I adjust my way of behaving. Right? When we go to a different country, a different culture, we adjust how we communicate and how we behave, isn't it? Right? When I visit India, if I just act like an American, it doesn't work very well. People really don't appreciate it. Yeah?
Yeah.
So in the same way, when I know my type, and I'm dealing with people who have other types, so maybe I don't need a lot of appreciation and approval. Maybe that's not what feeds me, but maybe that's what feeds somebody else. So as a teacher, I remember once giving an assignment, and one of my students just didn't want to do the assignment. And it was a student who was normally very cooperative. I didn't usually have a problem with her at all. And so my response was initially to the whole class, okay, this is just what we're doing, and you just have to do it and get it done, and that's just what it is. And she basically just, you know, sunk her feet in the ground and said, I'm not doing it. So I took her out of the classroom, and at first I was trying to explain analytically, logically, because that is what would move me. And I wasn't getting anywhere. And then I looked at her and I said, look, I understand you don't want to do this. I understand there's some kind of issue with it. But if you have this whole rebellion thing in front of everyone, I'm not going to be able to manage the class. The whole thing's going to fall apart. Instead of being able to get this assignment done, I'm going to spend all this time just on classroom management. Would you be willing to just get this assignment done just as a personal favor for me? And she said, sure. That was the end of everything. And I'm like, oh. Wow. I had this one student who was very careful and systematic. Everything had to be done exactly in order. So it was time for the achievement test. And in achievement tests, you're supposed to do the hard problems first and then the easy problems. But I knew if I told her, don't do the problems in order, she would panic. So instead, what I said to her is, the numbers on the problems don't indicate the order. That's just for grading purposes. The actual order of these questions is you do the hard ones first and you do the easy ones afterwards. That's the correct order. So I put it in her language. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. Yes? Yes? All right. So we have one more we're going to look at here. This one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so again, we're going to go across the rows. So the D is like activity, business, bigness, challenge, competition, doing things, hard work, major productions, to be in charge, and to fight and violence. The I is like exposure to people, lots of activity, short-term projects, to be on the go, prestige, selling while they play, making people happy, and making people laugh. S is like peace, stabilizing things, to wait, friendly environments to finish the job, and teamwork. C is like consistency, detail, confirmation, creativity, perfection, and orderliness. D's can be critical of poorly performed tasks, complete amazing amounts of work, need to learn to delegate responsibility. That's really work, not walk. Need to learn to delegate responsibility, run roughshod over people, wrongly believe that approval and encouragement leads to complacency. Eyes can be higher than a kite or lower than a skunk, have lots of friends, need self-discipline, wrongly believe that talking and doing are synonymous. S's are motivated by helping others, are seldom in a hurry, need lots of appreciation, will support you, stay with proven methods, and are sentimental. C's have good imaginations, tend to irritate people, tend to be perfectionists, have lots of questions, usually have high IQs, want directions followed. These are goal-oriented, hard-to-please, industrious, performance-conscious, self-confident and firm, eyes are fun to watch, great starters, poor finishers, likable, prone to exaggerate, and easily excitable. S's are easily manipulated, reluctant decision-makers, the sweetest people in the world, loyal friends, poor starters, great finishers. C's are impossible to satisfy, meticulous, good thinkers, logical, self-sacrificing, and talented. Now, if you want a project going, it might be nice to have both a great starter and a great finisher in the project, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? You can see how it's designed for us to work together.
Yeah.
You know, you have the people who are the great starters, and they get everybody enthused and they're inspirational, and we're going to do this big thing, and we're going to talk about it, and then it... that dies after like 2 days, right? And then yeah, the other people are like, well, okay, I can just wait. And we'll just wait, and yeah, we'll be patient. And then once the eyes get it started, then they can take it through and be part of the team and get it done. Right? Okay. What they don't like, these do not like indecision, lazy people, slow activities, slow people, taking orders, and talkers who don't produce. The eyes don't like being ignored, being ridiculed, being isolated, and doing repetitive tasks. The S's don't like insensitivity, misunderstanding, surprises. There's a person I visit, and he tells me, my wife does not like surprises. Have all the schedules arranged in advance. To be yelled at, sarcasm, being pushed. So again, these are your really friendly people. These are your team players. These are your real loyal people. They don't like conflict. They really don't like conflict. They want people to get along. They're the peacemakers. Okay, and C's don't like being criticized, sudden changes, hypocrites, mistakes, unnecessary interruptions, and broken promises. These people can be very focused. Okay, and D's want you to be quick, specific, to the point, and a winner. So if you're talking to a D, like, can you get to the point? I's want you to be fun, responsive, stimulating, positive, upbeat, enthusiastic. Hey, come on, let's go have a fun time. Let's get this thing done. The S's want you to be kind and not harsh, pleasant, patient, and understanding. They're really looking for that connection. The C's want you to be accommodating, honest, accountable, accurate, careful, and analytical. So again, if we can understand, okay, this is my nature, but my spouse, my kids have a different nature. If I give them what I want, that's not going to be what they need for their needs, for what kind of person that they are. Okay, so this is a little overview of the DISC. As I say, there are many other ways of understanding personality. This is just a four-part system. Most of us are going to have one of them dominant and another one subordinate.
Mm-hmm. It's like this.
And, you know, you may have, like, it tends not to be opposite. So, like, D and S are opposite and I and C are opposite. So people tend to be, like, if they have a subordinate one, it may be S and C, or it may be I and S, or it may be D and I, or I and D, like that. And again, these are not equally distributed in the population. So this is, it's not 25, 25, 25, 25. Okay, before we go on to our next stuff, which is all from Shastra, I'd like us to think of some leaders in ISKCON who exemplify these different personality types. This helps me to understand that people have understood this. So can anyone think of some leaders in ISKCON who are D's?
I don't know any D's.
Did any of you know Tamal Krishnamurti?
Yeah,
so Tamal Krishnamurti is kind of the epitome of a D. I'm trying to think of someone today.
There's people serving and organizing big preachers.
Yeah, but a lot of... Okay, what about I?
Indrajimna
Maharaj, yeah, yes. Also, Bhakti Tirtha Swami. If any of you knew Bhakti Tirtha Swami, is an I. S.
Harilas Prabhu could be a D.
I don't know him well enough, but I wouldn't be surprised. S.
Krishna Kripa comes to mind, but he's not
that well known.
Bhakti
Chaitanya Maharaj. Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj definitely is. And Radhana Swami also did.
Yeah.
And you know Rupad Swami.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So I want to give these examples to show that you can become an advanced devotee of any type. It's not that becoming advanced in Krishna consciousness, you're going to change from an S to a D or a D to a C. One is going to become an advanced devotee of their type. Now, who do you want to manage the account? Which of these types do you want to manage the money, the accounts?
C.
A C.
C.
Who do you want to send to preach in Saudi Arabia?
I.
An I or a D?
D, sir.
Probably a D. Yeah. A very high risk taker. You know, like Prabhupada sent Tamal Krishnamurti to preach in?
China.
Do you know, when Prabhupada was trying to buy the Mayapur property, he had sent so many people to try to close the deal. It was very complicated. Buying property in India is not like buying property in America, to put it very mildly. I don't know if doing anything in America. Anyway. So he had all these people trying to close the deal, negotiate it, and they failed and they failed and they failed. And finally Prabhupada called Tamal Krishnamurti. He said, "You do it." And Prabhupada gave him the cash. Gave him all the money in cash. He said, "I know you're going to do it." So some idea? Now I'm going to tell you something else, is that each culture tends to think that one of these types is ideal. And people who grow up in that culture often try to pretend to be that type. So if we're not so comfortable with who we are, we may try to pretend to others that we're different from who we are. And because each culture has a certain type that it considers to be ideal, often people in that culture will try to pretend to fit into that ideal. Can you think of any place in the world where the C type would be ideal?
Japan.
Yes, definitely. Any other places where the C type would be considered to be ideal? Any places where the C type would be considered to be ideal?
India?
No. I finally figured out what is the ideal type in India?
No. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely the S. You know when I figured that out? It was when I was at a Bharat Natyam. My daughter and I had gone to a Bharat Natyam performance. And in between each group that was performing, there was a 10-minute wait. And when it got to the third 10-minute wait, we looked at each other and we went, S. The patient waiting patiently.
Traditional.
Wait, very traditional, supportive, team player.
Keep everybody happy.
Keeping everybody happy, and very, very patient, poor starters, but good finishers, and very, you know, sure, we will all get along. Can you wait a little longer? Yes, very much yes. Okay, what kind of cultures have the I as their ideal type? By another word, C would be Germany, by the way. Germany is very much C. Also be I.
It's like America.
Canada.
Like I is D. Canada is also S. Canada is also S. Yeah. What place would be I?
Brazil.
Very good. What other place would be I?
China. Anywhere is fun going.
Mexico is also I, yes. Spain, Greece, the Mediterranean countries generally. Spain, Italy, Greece, France is definitely I. And D, America. The guy riding his horse alone. The astronaut. You know, that's all very much the D personality. Huh?
The Trump.
He's really out of control, though. That's an out of control thing. That's a Tamagoon. It's a D, out of control in Tamagoon. So I always like to do this little exercise to see if you can understand what this means. You can see that if you're an S type growing up in America, you might try to act like you're a D. Right? But it doesn't really work. Right? If we try to act like we're someone that we're not, we always feel very uncomfortable. So understanding this can understand, okay, what kind of things should I be doing? And what kind of things should I be doing for Krishna? What kind of things should I be doing in my work? Right, I was in Germany, and I was giving a class, and there were a bunch of families there with little children. There were a bunch of, like, 3-4-year-old children in the class. So I noticed that wherever they would go, one of the kids, one little girl, was always managing all the other kids. She was telling them where to go, and what to do. And so afterwards, I said, who is this girl's parents? So that was introduced to the mother and father. And I say, what do you do? So we were in Frankfurt, but they were from another part of Germany. So he said, oh, we manage the center. They were leaders. And I said, you know your daughter, who's 3 years old, I said, you know your daughter's a leader, right? I said, we're always telling her to stop bossing other people. I said, no, you have to train her how to lead other people properly. All right? So this is what we're going to go to now. Is
spiritual.
We're going to go to now from Shastra. Well, this can all be used materially or spiritually. But we're going to go to now through two ways of understanding our nature from Shastra. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about childhood and how our nature is exemplified from childhood. So the first one we're going to look at is the 6 opulences.
So Mataji, before you go, just a question. So you said yes. For C, the most thing is to they manage finance. And for yes, so is there anything like what
I was giving a general example. As I said, I don't have time for anything more than a general example. And we're going to go to occupations. We're going to do that right now. Now we're going into the area of Shastra that talks about connecting nature with livelihood. Remember we talked about that the main reason to study our nature is to connect it with 2 things, with livelihood and what we're going to do for Krishna as far as our service and in his mission. You know, Srila Prabhupada does say that we should perform the angas of bhakti according to our personal taste. So all of us are supposed to chant 16 rounds. And we're supposed to read the scriptures, but Prabhupada says some people really like to worship the deity, some people really like to distribute books, and one should do service according to one's taste. And Krishna is very firm, and all over the Shastra is very firm, that how we maintain ourselves should be according to our nature. So we're going to look at Shastra in the terms of, primarily in the terms of livelihood. So the first thing we're going to look at is 6 ways to be rich. So I assume nobody wants to be poor, yes? Everybody wants to have a prosperous, rich life. And often we think of richness in terms of cash. How much cash do I have in the bank? Now it's interesting that we think that way because we all know many cash-rich people who are not happy. Yes? Just open the news any day and you will find an account of at least one cash-rich person who is not happy. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Yes? And we also know cash-poor people who are happy. Does everyone know a cash-poor person who is happy? Yes. So we know that there's not a one-to-one correspondence between how much cash you have and how rich and prosperous you feel your life to be. If one feels, I have a rich, prosperous life, there's not a one-to-one correspondence between that way of feeling and the numbers that show up in your bank account. Am I correct? Yes? Okay? No, I mean, obviously, we'd all like to have a lot of numbers in our bank account, but that's not the main thing. So the Shastra gives 6 ways to feel rich. Now, all of us would like to feel rich in all of these ways. It's not that we don't care about one of them, but some of them are much more important to us than others. So for each of us, we're going to have 1, 2, or 3 maybe of these 6 ways of being rich. If we don't have this, our life is just miserable. We need to have that in order to feel we have a rich life. And the others, we may be, well, it'll be nice to have that. But if I have it or don't have it, it's not so crucial. So the first one we're going to look at is Aishvarya. So Aishvarya is connected to the word Ishvara. And it has to do with leadership and power. Now, it can have something to do with just having a lot of autonomy in your own life. being a controller in your own life, not having a lot of other people telling you what to do, having a lot of autonomy. But Aishwarya also can have to do with having a position of leadership. Now, I think often the word power has a negative connotation. But power can be used wonderfully, and we need people in the world who thrive on power. If we don't have anyone in the world who thrives on power, the world is going to become chaos. We need people for whom power is an energizer and who know how to use it nicely. So this Aishwarya is the richness of leading other people, directing other people, and helping other people through leadership, or sometimes being very self-directed. The next kind of richness we're going to look at is virya. So virya means strength. It can also mean sexual potency, but it means health. Health and strength. Anyone who's involved in healing professions, for anyone who's involved, like if you're a physical therapist or you're a doctor or if you're teaching yoga, then virya is going to be important to you. Or if you're a dancer, bless you. Somebody even who has an herbal business, you know, virya is going to be something very important. Now, because again, everybody wants health and everybody wants strength and vitality, but for a person where that's a really important part of what makes their life rich. Right? I was just reading yesterday about this one writer who says she spends sometimes 20 or 22 hours a day writing at her typewriter. She only sleeps like 2 to 4 hours a day. For such a person, you know, virya is not very important. It just isn't. This is a person who gets, obviously, like, no exercise, right? And is just in the realm of the mind. So for many people, virya is not that important, although everybody wants to be healthy. Then we have yasha. Yasha is a very interesting way of being rich. So yasha means the fame that you get from being a good person. In the Bhagavatam, there's a personality yasha, who's the child of kirti and dharma. So kirti means people are talking about you. It's related to the word kirtan. But there's a lot of people we talk about that aren't famous for doing good things. Yes? Mm-hmm. Right? So yasha is not like that. Yasha is people are talking about you because you're dharmic, because you're responsible. So therefore, yasha has to do with having community. It's the wealth of having community. There are people you know you, they like you, they respect you, they're there for you, they're supportive. For many people, a community is essential. I mean, there's many people I speak to and they say, wherever I live, I really want to have a vibrant community. That's really important to me. And other people, it doesn't really matter. Right? My other daughter-in-law's father passed away recently. And I remember his wife telling me how that basically his friends were his family and 2 or 3 other people. He just, other than family and 2 or 3 friends, he wasn't really interested in community. It just wasn't that important to him. For other people, community is everything. Or they really need community to feel rich. And they want to have a community where they're loved and respected in the community. Then there's Shri. So Shri is the richness of beauty. So you go in some people's homes and there's, you know, original oil paintings on the walls and all of the furniture matches and they have a gorgeous sound system where they're playing beautiful music and they've landscaped their gardens and you go in other people's houses and they just have some poster on the wall without a frame. Right? I was in one person's house. They're obviously very, very wealthy people in terms of cash. But they had this poster that this poster of the deities where the faces had been drawn. It was this huge, larger than life poster in their temple room. And it was like, ooh, there's Radha-Madhava from Mayapur. You know, and I'm thinking, my God, I could never look at this for more than 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some people, it's not so important to them. The beauty of art, of music, of gardens, what kind of clothes they have. And also Shri has to do with the charismatic leadership. So Aishwarya has to do with the leadership of power, but Shri has to do with the leadership of charisma. So you're also leading people, but you're leading people in another way, not because you have authority over them, but if you think about someone like Gandhi, who was a charismatic leader rather than a leader of power, right? He didn't have any kind of literal legal power over people. And it just kind of splendor. Now, if you think of someone who's in the performing arts, let's say they're a dancer, they're going to be interested in Sri and Virya. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sri also has to do a lot with affection and care. Again, that kind of charisma. Then you have Gyan. So Gyan is the richness of knowledge. So like I have a friend that when you go into her house, you're not sure if it's a home or a library. She actually has rolling bookcases like you have in a library, because she doesn't have enough wall space for all of her books. Right? So people who are always learning, when they go online, what are they doing? They're reading to find information. They want to learn something. They want to learn about this thing. They want to learn about that thing. They want to learn about this thing. And other people really don't care. There's a lot of people, if they know how to do their job, you know, they know how to take care of their house, they're having fun with their family, they don't really care what the capital of, you know, Chile is. And the mating habits of the ruby-throated hummingbird. And it just doesn't matter to them at all, you know. They're interested in what knowledge they need to get by, but for other people, their curiosity and their knowledge, the more that they know, gives them wealth. And then perhaps the most interesting way of being rich is vairagya. And we often think of vairagya as the opposite. We think of vairagya, which means renunciation, as people who aren't interested in prosperity, but actually it's a different kind of prosperity. It's having freedom. Right? So the traveling performers, right, who live out of a van, that's vairagya. Right? People who don't want to have a lot of possessions. Right? I know that one sannyasi in ISKCON, so he was at, someone wanted to put some furniture in his office, and he said, "You're taking away my prosperity if you put furniture in my office." So this free, to be free from a lot of possessions, to be free from a lot of monthly bills, to have freedom from a tight schedule. You know, a lot of people who want to be their own boss, they really might feel that this vairagya or this freedom is an important richness in their life. So looking at these six ways to be rich, when we look at what kind of livelihood we want to have, we think about what kind of prosperity is really important to me. If I want gyan, vairagya, and shri, then maybe I travel around singing philosophical songs. Whatever, sure. Is this clear?
Yes.
So you see, you know, what's important to me, and what's important to me is not going to necessarily be important to somebody else. And if my livelihood doesn't provide me with the kind of riches that are important to me, I'm not going to be happy in my livelihood no matter how much cash I have. You know, I could look at my bank account and there could be seven figures in it, but if I'm not getting the kind of richness that makes me feel prosperous, I'm going to have a poor life. And if my bank account has only four figures in it, but I have the richness in my life that makes me feel prosperous, then I will be happy. Now we're going to look at the one that I'm sure we're most familiar with in the Hare Krishna movement. But I hope that I'm going to explain it from a different perspective, a little different point of view, so that we can kind of get rid of our stereotypes about it and consider it in a new way. So we're going to look at general fields of work, fields of livelihood. So throughout the Shastra, there are four fields of livelihood. And you might think, well, why does Krishna and all the sages, why do they take the hundreds of thousands of jobs you could do and divide it up into four? What are these differences of four? So there's basically four main categories of work, which all involve a different sort of nature, and ultimately, which we don't have time to discuss today, a different kind of dharma. So we're going to look first at what we're called the field of artistry. And by the way, I'm working with a devotee named Rukmini on a book about spiritualizing career. And so what I told you about the six ways of being rich and now about the fields of work is from the research that we're doing for our book. She's got a PhD in mathematics. And we're coming at this from not only a Shastric point of view, but also from the point of view of looking at empirical studies on occupation. So the people in the field of artistry, they provide all of the pleasure of society. They provide basically all of the rasa, all of the taste in society, and all the functionality in society. Then there's people in the field of resources. They expand the wealth and the profit for society. They're directing the flow of resources from earth, water, and fire, from the animals, from the land, and to all of society. Yes. Then there is the people in the government. So they're protecting from internal and external threats, giving peace and order and care, making sure everybody has everything that they need, creating rules and order, infrastructure. And government can also mean people who work in something like NATO or Interpol or the UN or kind of, you know, quasi-government agencies or non-government organizations that do the work of government. Then there's the field of ideas that provides wisdom, guidance, truth, and research and study and counseling and religious guidance to society. So we're going to look at the temperaments of people in these fields. Now, one thing that we're going to find in Shastra is Shastra generally defines the temperaments of people in these fields looking at people who are already expert. And I think one of the difficulties with that is if I'm young and I'm just looking at what career should I go into, I'm not already expert in my field, and therefore the description of the expert may not resonate with me. Also, remember that our nature can be used well or poorly. So the descriptions in the Shastras are of those who are using their nature well. And we also want to look at kind of a neutral descriptor. So you haven't necessarily used it well or poorly yet. You just have a general nature. So in the field of artistry, the disposition is taking pride in, I made that, I cleaned that, I fixed that. A sense of using tools or using your body as a tool. Helping others. Having others use what we do. You know, making pictures that go on somebody else's wall. Doing something that entertains others. Supporting others. An expert is going to have authentic and honest service, satisfaction in the work itself. And people in the field of artistry tend to be happy with having a family and a home and helping others. Generally, people in this field do not have grandiose aspirations. They are happy with perfecting their craft. And the main questions that people in this field asked about their work is it beautiful and is it supportive? So if the main questions that we want answered in our work is it beautiful, is it supportive, that's some indication that we're in the field of artistry. Then in the field of resources, these are people who like to, and I have to use the word play, because our nature will feel like play to us. These are people who want to play with money, with land, with crops, with animals. Their ambitions, according to Bhagavatam 11 Canto, is they're rarely satisfied. They're called always thirsty. They like to take risks. They're very goal-oriented. They're experts in systems thinkers. They understand the flows of resources, and they know how to direct those flows so they can tap into them. Now, one very important thing about people in the field of resources, which is not understood or appreciated by people in the other fields, is that people in the fields of resources want to direct the flow of resources not only to society in general, but also for their own profit. Now, often they're criticized for this, but if they're not directing the flow of resources for their own profit, then what they're doing is not sustainable. And the people in the other fields who don't have that interest cannot sustain activities in the field of resources. They'll give too much away, they'll give too much to others. So in this field, they understand putting your own oxygen mask on first is means that I've got to direct the flow of resources to my own prosperity in order to help society in general. The main questions these people have about their livelihood is it sustainable and is it regenerative? Those are the main things that they are going to care about. Now, over the field of government, these are people who are really concerned with fairness and rules. Things have to be fair, things have to be according to the rules. They want to make people happy. They want to make sure that everybody has what they need and everybody's happy. They want to be heroes. They want to care for people. They want to protect them. You can think the people in the government, they're kind of like big parents. These people often argue or fight easily. They have a lot of courage, and they have what we call a tough skin. Right? They basically, criticism just kind of goes off them. Yes, they have a very take-charge mentality. An expert in this field is going to be goal-oriented, decisive, determined. Again, a systems thinker, but a systems thinker on a bigger scope than those in the field of resources. So those in the field of resources are system thinkers in terms of the specific resources that they manage. But in government, people are systems thinkers for the whole system. How are we directing all the flow of resources and making sure that everybody gets what they need? They can see emerging trends and needs. They're heroic. They have determination. They're resourceful. They're very generous. The main questions these people ask about their work is it just? In other words, is it fair? And is it honorable? In other words, is it ethical? They're mostly concerned about justice and ethics. Then people in the field of ideas, they like to play with language or maybe like to play with math. And their purpose is to find truth. So they love playing either with words or with math or both for the purpose of finding truth. They're very curious, and they tend to see the patterns in ideas and relationships and in systems. They may like to research or to study, or they may like to teach. An expert in this field is very peaceful and forgiving and is very tolerant and very wise. These people like to collect knowledge, understand it, repackage it, and share it. And the main questions that these people ask about their work is it true and is it wise? Is it true and is it wise? Now, because people in the field of artistry may support people in the other three fields, they may have two sets of questions that energize them. So if a person is feeling, well, I want my work to be beautiful and supportive, but also just and honorable, then they're probably in the field of artistry assisting people in the field of government. If they're thinking, I want it to be beautiful and supportive, but I'm also interested in truth and wisdom, probably in the field of artistry assisting people in the field of ideas, rather than just working in artistry in and of itself. Now, how do we find what our basic nature is? Well, just kind of the questions and the charts you went through today are also very helpful. In addition, I think we can do a little bit of introspection as to what have I been doing since early childhood that other people have pointed out to me and maybe even criticized me for. So I'd like to ask you, what do you think I was criticized for from the age of 3 by my teachers in preschool? They went to my parents and said, your daughter is doing this. And my parents criticized me for that the whole time I was growing up. You're doing it again. What do you think I was doing?
Asking questions?
I was asking questions, but that wasn't it.
You were arguing? Or like challenging?
I was challenging, but you got to be more specific.
Teaching!
The teacher said, your daughter will not be a student. She will not just play with the other kids and be a student. She's always coming up to us teachers and saying, see that kid, that child over there? You should be doing this with them. You should be teaching. She's always telling us how to teach. And the whole time I was growing up, my parents would say, would you please stop being a teacher? Now, what a shame. What a shame. It wasn't until I was 24 years old and I met my god sister, Jo Chiramayi, and she taught me how to teach that I realized that I'm a teacher. I grew up being ashamed of who I am and trying to repress and stop who I am. That situation, unfortunately, is very, very, very common. Would you stop showing off? Why do you always have to be center stage? Maybe the kid is meant to be on center stage. Or the example I gave you where the parents, who were both leaders, was trying to stop their 3-year-old child from being a leader. Which is very interesting. It was their own nature. And they were like, why is she always bossing the other kids around? So one way we can tell what our nature is, was there something that our parents and our teachers and our brothers and sisters were getting on our case about from a young age? Why don't you stop doing that? Do you always have to do that? Why do you have to be like that? Why do you have to be like that? Because our nature cannot be what? Krishna says, what use will?
Repression.
It cannot be repressed. So our parents and teachers were not even able to reward us out of our nature, punish us out of our nature, shame us out of our nature. They would not have been able to put us in circumstances or deal with us in such a way that our nature would go away. And if we didn't know how to use it properly, we were probably annoying everybody in our environment with it. So one way we can tell about what our nature is, was it something that was annoying people? Was it something that people were asking us to stop or to modify repeatedly, and no matter how much we tried, it didn't work? Again, our nature is something we're going to do automatically, like breathing. It's just who we are. It's how we operate. Another way we can understand our nature is by thinking of some circumstance where we felt really happy and energized. Sometime where we didn't want to sleep. We would miss meals. Come on for lunch. I'll come in a minute. You know, where we didn't want to stop doing what we were doing, where we felt fully ourselves. In psychology, they call this a state of flow. Now, I find it fascinating that even people who aren't religious, if they use their nature for the purpose of a higher good, they also get this kind of energy and happiness and flow. So just imagine if we use our nature for Krishna. If a materialistic atheist uses their nature in the service of society, they will feel this almost samadhi-like state where time and space goes away. But that's a little reflection of the samadhi we can feel when we use our nature for Krishna. And that is the perfection of our life in this body. In terms of our bodily life, Krishna consciousness teaches, Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita. That is the whole Bhagavad Gita, basically, if you really want to look at it. The whole Bhagavad Gita is, hey, Arjuna, this is your nature. Please use it for me in my service. I have something I'd like you to do with it. And at the same time, develop our ultimate, eternal, spiritual nature, which is beyond this body, and engage that with Krishna in the spiritual world. So if we think of any time when we felt really alive, what is it that makes us feel alive? What is it that makes us feel prosperous, that makes us feel like I'm being authentically who I am, in a way that's positively making a contribution to my happiness and the happiness of others? Then we're going to hit on what is our nature. And we'll probably also find that it's something that annoys people when it's not appreciated or not used properly. And it's probably something that we haven't been able to fix because it's not fixable. All it can be, the only way we can fix it is to use it properly. So again, it's now 3:20, so we started a little late, but I'm not able today to go into depth with this, but I hope this has given you at least some overview. And I find it very exciting that although these principles are understood to some degree in modern psychology and sociology, it's not that they're not, but these are principles that have been explained in our scriptures for millions and millions of years. And they're explained in a depth and in a richness that is not able to be found just by empirical studies. So I invite you all to go deeper into this. Please give us your blessings that we can have our... We're hoping to have our book finished by January. Yeah. We're hoping... We're writing it in language for the general public. So we're hoping it's a way that we can bring the knowledge of the Gita and the Bhagavatam to people in general. You know, how to spiritualize your career. How to have what you do to maintain yourself be a source of spiritual enlivenment and a source of connection with the divine. So I thank you very much. We could take 10 minutes for questions, and that will be it. Yes?
Master, sorry. I didn't catch the fourth field of work.
Ideas. Yes?
How do you explain the how our nature is, like, and what are the different aspects, and how, what category we come in, and how it does help us? But if you look from this spiritual point of view, typically you're supposed to follow what your seniors tell you. So now let's say even somebody's nature is to, let's say, lead or something else.
So what's the responsibility of the seniors?
But senior may or may not be able to perceive what your nature is.
What's the responsibility of the seniors, according to Shastra?
They should see your nature and...
And engage you accordingly.
Engage.
And if someone doesn't do that, then they're not situated properly.
Yeah, but...
If people in a position of leadership are not able to discern the natures of people and engage them according to their natures, they shouldn't be in a position of leadership. Or they should learn how to be a leader properly. So it's definitely a challenge in our Krishna conscious society, but it's one of the things that we really need to do in a Krishna conscious society. That people who are in a position of engaging others need to be able to discern what are people's natures and engage them accordingly. Now, one reason sometimes that's not done is that people have, we have these immediate needs and we just have to get people to do them, and if it's your nature or not, oh well, too bad. That's okay for a very temporary emergency, but if that's our long-term policy, our movement will not grow sufficiently. Our movement is going to grow sufficiently. If people know, when I come to the Hare Krishna movement, people will help me discover what is my nature and engage it accordingly in the mission. We would have people lining up around the blocks to join our movement. And we wouldn't have any trouble getting all the work done. But when we focus on just let's get the work done and never mind what you're good at or what you're not good at, you're a warm body, just go do it, then people gradually stop doing things for the movement because they're not satisfied. And also when we do something that's not our nature, we will cause havoc, which I don't have time to talk about today. But in our book, we analyze for every possible combination, like someone in the field of ideas working in artistry working in the field of ideas, someone in government working in the field of resources. We analyze every possible combination of if you cross fields and what havoc that causes for society. And that's going to be true in a microcosm in ISKCON. I mean, just think in a practical level. If people who are meant to be in the field of resources work in the field of government, what happens? They're just looking at their own area of resources and their own profit. It creates havoc in government. But let's say someone who's supposed to be in the field of government works in the field of resources. They don't care about making a profit.
Bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy is those in the field of artistry. Bureaucracy, yeah.
Okay.
And people who are in the field of artistry and work for government are the bureaucrats. All the bureaucrats in government are people in the field of artistry working to help the field of government. People in the field of government are not bureaucrats. Mm. So when people in the field of government work in the field of resources, they don't care about making a profit. These are like these businesses that are, you know, they're spending all their profits helping feed people. And the business isn't sustainable. Eventually, they end up having to sell the business to someone in the field of resources. A good example of that is the body shop. So the body shop was a business founded, it was working like a government. It was a business founded to help people and to take care of people. But it wasn't long-term sustainable. As the business got bigger, it was the wrong mentality. And they had to sell it to people in the field of resources. So whenever you cross fields, I mean, Krishna says this, is don't do somebody else's work.
Yeah.
Better to die doing your own work than to do somebody else's work. So when we do somebody else's work, we're unhappy, we're miserable, we end up showing our nature but in the wrong way. We end up showing our nature in a destructive way. And we cause havoc in the social body. It's like if you try to ask the heart muscles to be a brain or the brain muscles to be a liver.
So you mentioned sometimes it's just a matter of need in terms of what people do, and I think that might be the case a lot of the time where, is there always going to be that balance between the types of people that are needed and the types of people that are available?
Well, that would be the question of, if we want to look at the universal body, if we want to look at God's body as the universe, which is one of the forms of God, that his body is the universe. And each of these fields and subfields of work represents some kind of organ or part of the universal body. So we would have to assume that as this is God's body, that he has actually provided enough entities in different areas to do all of these things. Now, of course, all of us have to do some things to live that are not necessarily what we like to do. I mean, everybody has to have clean their house and clean their clothes and take a shower and cook and, unless you have enough cash to hire servants to do all these things. So everybody has to do some things that are not necessarily their nature. And even if something is your nature, some parts of it you may not like. I really like producing books, but I don't like every part of producing books. Some parts of it I find very tedious and very difficult for me. So that's going to be true no matter what. Working according to your nature doesn't mean that every single thing you do, every part of the day, is going to be on a material level enlivening. But if we have a situation where people are long-term engaged in something that's against their nature, then we have a real problem both for that individual and for society. So I'd like to go on the assumption that we do have the right mix between needs and nature, and it's just that we're allocating people wrongly. So I'd like to have that assumption because I'd like to assume that the person running the show and whose body it isn't going to have, an excess of heart muscle cells and, not enough intestinal cells. So that everything must be there in the proper order. And I'd like to say if we ran a society where we engage people according to their nature and only very rarely in an emergency situation ask them to do something else, that we would start attracting more people. And we would attract people to fill those needs that are not being met. Yes?
So how can we bring this nature test into the schools, etc., so kids are not basically...
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't that be wonderful? One of the chapters we have in our book is called Vision for a Whole Society. And one of the things that I'm really putting a lot of emphasis on in my life is especially meeting with ISKCON leaders and talk about what is our vision for a Krishna-conscious society as a whole? Where would we like to go with this? Because I think unless we have a vision for society outside of our temples and our own communities, we're not going to be able to direct our own preaching and our own mission very well. But yes, this is one of the things that we should be doing. We in the Hare Krishna movement should be able to go to the educators of the world and say, hey, this is how you could educate children so that they'll be happy and productive in the world. Now, there's some inclination like that in some of the schools already. It's not like there isn't any inclination like that. But often they don't really know how to do it. And most of the schools are still so much factory schools that it's too much of a one-size-fits-all, even if they talk about it.
For example, let's say like in the U.S., like Bellevue, they do some gifted exam. Maybe we can at least...
That would be very nice.
Add something so at least some classes can be channelized into that.
That would be very nice. I mean, I'm hoping that when Rukmini and I finish our book, I mean, what we're hoping to do is travel around to universities and start, we're looking at educating young people who are looking at what career they want to go into or just starting out in their career, but we also would like to train the teachers and leaders of society. So that's our goal, to do that, to train not only the devotees in ISKCON, but people in the world. And I really feel that pretty much everyone in the world would like to have a happy, satisfying, prosperous life. I have this assumption that the vast majority, if not everyone in the world, would like a way of living that resonates with their own nature and is satisfying. I don't think everyone in the world wakes up in the morning and says, I want to learn how to love a personal God. I don't think that that's true. Or even wakes up in the morning and says, I want to become enlightened, I want to become self-realized. But I do think that everybody in the morning is thinking, I'd like to have a happy day today. I'd like to have a day where I'm fulfilled, and where I'm happy and where I feel that I can make a meaningful contribution to the world of who I am. That me, my unique self, can give something to the world that it doesn't have without me. And that's something I believe that everybody does want and that everybody does think of. And this is something that we can offer. And we can offer it in a way, I believe, that is unique, that goes beyond anything that's offered by just materialistic people. So I see that this particular way of looking at things is something that we who know the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita can really offer society. I'm hoping that we can do that. And I see this, that if it's offered properly, it becomes bhakti. If you go in and said, here, take up bhakti, they're like, but here, take up a system of where you can be truly who you are in the service of a greater good. You know what? That has to include bhakti. If it doesn't include bhakti, it's going to be incomplete.
Where do you think that it includes bhakti? You are almost talking about a Vedic age where the kids go to a guru and guru looks at the nature of them, kids, okay. He seems more like intelligent. Let's go put him the Brahmana. He's like more of a...
Well, because what I've discussed now is just one piece.
Mm-hmm.
Identifying your nature and linking it to your livelihood is one piece of career dharma. It's just one piece. It's not the only piece. The other pieces are things like giving in charity, having regular connection with the divine, which we call in Sanskrit yajna. A word that's, I think, grossly misunderstood sometimes because we translate it as sacrifice and people think it's like doing something for somebody else. But yajna means some sort of regular, for lack of a better word, ritual. It means dedicating everything to the Supreme. It means working without ego. It means staying within your own field, not crossing fields. It means competing within a field, cooperating between fields. There's all these principles of career dharma. Besides just finding your nature and linking your nature to career. That's just one. So, in our book, we have isolated, I think, I hope, all of the principles of career dharma and explained them in terms for the general public. And one of them is bhakti. Even if you see the divine as the universe, which has become a very popular term among spiritual people today, the universe... But guess what? That's in the Bhagavatam. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. God is the universe. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The Virat Rupa in the Bhagavad Gita, so many chapters in the Bhagavatam of God as the universal body. And I got this idea first when reading, it was a book that Prabhupada had written before he came to America and never published while he was with us. It was a book that was published later by Tripurari Swami on Ramananda Samvada, the discussion between Ramananda Roy and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Prabhupada had written it, but it hadn't been published. And there Prabhupada talked about Varnashram as being connected with the universal body, with the universal form of God. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's it. So we present four ways of perceiving the divine. We present the universal form, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So that's something that can be given to anybody in a very non-sectarian way. And without that, you're not going to find full satisfaction in your career. I mean, if you apply any of the principles of career dharma, you're going to find more satisfaction than if you don't. It's not an on-off switch, it's a continuum. The more of the principles that you apply, the happier you'll be. And if you apply all of them, then you'll have boundless transcendental happiness realized through transcendental senses. Okay, we do have to stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I hope that this was helpful for everybody.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Yeah.